Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I hope all of you have had a good rest of your week since I was on the air last. Hard to believe that today is Friday, and hard to believe that tomorrow marks the first weekend in the month of November. Time has gone by very quick, especially given that we're not now already into the start of November. But the older we get, time itself just moves quick. I know I've said that many of times before, but it is something that we can't take for granted in, with regards to time, but how we choose to make the most of the time that we have day in and day out, whether it's through work or it's through something that we're passionate about in terms of a hobby or just a special interest. It's always up to us as individuals as to how we choose to make the most of the time that we have. Because if we're not careful, it can become all the more of a fragile commodity. I know that sounds awkward and a little odd, but at the same time, it's just one of those things that we can't take for granted. I mean, there are a lot of things that we shouldn't take for granted, but sometimes when we get caught up in our own world, it is easy to get caught up in the moment and take something for granted and then have to be reminded that we're not supposed to be going down that avenue. You know, oftentimes we think of, you know, days or dates, like, for example, tomorrow being November 4th, you know, most of us are going to say, okay, well, November 4th, that's a Saturday, or it's just November 4th. I mean, what could be so special about November 4th? Well, I do happen to know from a historical perspective that tomorrow marks the 44th anniversary of an event that took place in Iran. Believe it or not, in Iran's capital being Tehran, 44 years ago on this date in 1979, 52 Americans from the American embassy in Tehran were taken hostage by revolutionaries, those whom were anti-Shah. What I mean by Shah, for you young people, is a ruler. His name was Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, best known as the Shah. He ruled Iran for about 27 years, and come the start of 1979, he was ousted from power. While the Shah did westernize Iran, he did so via means of benefiting his nation through the assistance and aid of the United States and that of Great Britain through the oil industry. Women were allowed to have the right to vote, but those women who were allowed to participate in the Iranian government had to be loyal to the Shah. Otherwise, if they weren't loyal, they weren't allowed to have a voice. But long story short, it is unfortunate that 52 Americans were taken hostage. But at the same time, the Iranians wanted to send a message to the United States that, hey, you've been interfering on our soil for so long. You've been supporting a dictator who's actually oppressed many of our people. And now we feel that we need to stick it to you all. And so for 444 days, 52 Americans were held hostage. And some of the most barbaric, they were tortured. I don't know why any of them did not die. But the fact is they were held hostage for 444 days and were not officially released until January 20th of 1981 when Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president. The Iranian government deliberately did this to Jimmy Carter, who just turned 99 years old last month. As a matter of fact, when Jimmy Carter left office, one of his biggest missions was to try to not only learn from the mistakes that he made with regards to how he may have handled the whole hostage crisis, but how to bring peace into parts of the world where establishing peace was fragile unto itself. So we just need to be reminded that while, yes, you know, the date of November 4th may be just a date, it also should serve as a reminder that 52 Americans saw their lives changed forever, and that while, yes, they were released, the horrors they endured during 444 days of captivity is probably something that none of them would ever forget. The last I knew, I looked it up not long ago. There are 30 of the 52 hostages are still living today. The other 22 have passed on. But I have watched documentaries about it, and it's very powerful, to say the least, knowing how these Americans were taken hostage. Their stories should not be forgotten. Well, I do know that we've been in the throes of a very powerful story with Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. I will tell you all, folks, in this podcast segment episode, for starters, like always, we have lots of ground to cover. But this one, even while I was writing what I'm going to be sharing with you all tonight, it resonated with me all the more about not just survival, but for Dennis Hale, why am I alive when so many of my other fellow brothers are still out there fighting for their lives? Will any of my fellow crewmates come home alive? If so, how many? Will there be more than expected, or will there be less? The bottom line is that there has to be more than just I myself as a survivor. I think the last thing that probably would come across Dennis Hale's mind is the following: am I going to be the designated survivor? In other words, out of a crew of just shy of 30 men, am I going to be the only one left? And if so, how would I go forward? Well, that's what we're going to have to find out going forward in this podcast segment episode. I do know that from where we left off the previous time that I was on the air, we did learn that Dennis Hale not only was rescued, but he was admitted into a hospital, and that a lady by the name of Ruth Wintonhalter, who was the hospital director, had gone above and beyond to keep reporters away from Dennis Hale, given that Hale himself was simply not in the mood to give any information at this time. He had also, at the time, had not spoken to his wife. The Coast Guard was still conducting a search and rescue mission. So, in other words, Dennis Hale didn't want to jeopardize what the Coast Guard was still in the midst of doing. And he was still thinking about the crewmates whom perished on board that life raft. He was thinking about not only them, but perhaps their families. You can't fault the guy, because it's more than just crewmen on the vessel. It's also about everyone else on land, whom are going to be just as impacted. So let's get started with our first lead-off question. What did the Coast Guard do after they had discovered Morrell crewman Dennis Hale? Well, remember from the last episode, those Coast Guard crewmen whom rescued Dennis Hale did have a sigh of relief, knowing that they had accomplished something that they didn't think was doable, but at the same time, there is also sadness in that they had to they had to break through the ice three deceased crewmen whom were frozen like statues, and they had to put them in the helicopter in the cabin compartment, their bodies. So there is triumph, and then there is tragedy. So what do you all think that the Coast Guard did after they had discovered Morrell crewman Dennis Hale? For starters, the Coast Guard moved forward with a different level of urgency. They went from, say, mid-level urgency to the highest level of urgency possible. So they are having to raise the bar in terms of intensifying the search and rescue. Secondly, Coast Guard advised commercial freighters to stay on the lookout for missing crewmen including any debris, such as boat wreckage debris that could float along the water surface. Third, Coast Guard stations all over Michigan, whether the Coast Guard stations were along Lakes Huron, Erie, or Superior, and Michigan, I should say, because four of the five Great Lakes do touch Michigan. They border Michigan, and after all, Michigan has more lighthouses than any of the other Great Lakes states combined. I think the last I heard at one time, Michigan may have had at least 85 or 90 total, which is a very impressive number, but it could be a lot higher, to say the least. So, yes, Coast Guard stations all over Michigan went about joining the search. Harbor Beach sent two small boats in search of victims and survivors, including Coast Guard stations from Port Huron and Saginaw River, whom also sent boats. Two helicopters came south from Detroit. Traverse City in northwest Michigan sent two helicopters. Also, the Acacia, Bramble, and Mackinac, large-size Coast Guard vessels, joined the search. And on land, folks, roughly 100 volunteers, 100, went about canvassing the shoreline looking for morale victims and ship debris that could have potentially washed ashore. You know, it's one thing to conduct the search and rescue by water, but we must always remember that we need to also do one by land, because you never know what one might stumble upon when taking a walk along the shore. You know, yes, more often than not, we might see, you know, glass bottles on the shore. Sure, we might see other odd debris. But wouldn't it startle you if you saw a sailor's body washed along the shore with his life jacket on? It would startle me. It would make me realize that, okay, this could be someone whom was on that vessel, the SS Daniel J. Morrell. And I think if I saw a deceased crewman's body, I would need to contact not only, say, the local police department, but have them get a hold of the Coast Guard station nearby. And so this way, that not only can that body be retrieved, but perhaps a proper identification could be made, and that individual's loved ones could be notified in a timely manner. You know, many years ago, I'll tell you all this story here. I was a freshman in college. This was back in January of 1999. Hard to believe January of next year in 2024 will mark a quarter of a century since I first began college 25 years ago. I also find it hard to believe I've been out of school for 21 years. But long story short, I ran cross country and track and field for my first 2 years in college. Long story short, a group of us long distance runners went running out at a park, and we were running in different directions, which was fine. Long story short, someone approached me and said to me, "Would you be able to confirm if the man lying on the ground is alive or not, because I'm very worried that, given that he has not moved in the last couple of minutes." So I tried to approach the individual, and the owner's dog wouldn't let me get near him, so I knew something wasn't right. But as soon as the dog moved forward towards me, the man's arm came up and hit the ground, and I knew that was a bad sign. So luckily, I flagged down one of my assistant coaches who was certified in CPR, and she tried to save the man's life, but sadly he passed away. It really shook me up. I had never been in a situation like that before. And of course, any one of us would say that we would hope that we would never be in a situation like that again. But there are situations, or I should say circumstances, where we don't always have control over it. My teammates said to me that they said, you know, Kirk, I'm sorry that you stumbled upon that, but you did the right thing by flagging down the assistant coach, whom was certified in CPR. You did everything that there was to the best of your ability. So the bottom line is that, not to get off track, but the bottom line is that in this situation with the sinking of a vessel, yes, it's always easy for us to assume that the Coast Guard would spend all their time wanting as many personnel canvassing the water in search of debris and of individuals whom are unaccounted for, but at the same time, we need to have people by land, because one group of people can't do the entire mission. It has to be a joint effort. Why is December 3rd, 1966 important? The Coast Guard went about officially terminating the current active search and rescue mission due to rough weather and sailing conditions. Now, if you really want to understand rough weather, I'll give you some good examples here, folks, because it was talked about in the book. And after all, shouldn't we be reminded, given what we've already learned so far, that come the start of November and at the very end of November 1966 in Michigan, from the mainland to the Upper Peninsula, Michigan endured some very, very unseasonably cold temperatures. But in the middle of that month, Michigan endured unseasonably warm weather. So here we go with regards to a rough weather description. There was blinding snow that halted aircraft for extensive time periods. Well, blinding snow can do a lot of things. It can put traffic to a complete snarl, to where you end up getting a car pileup of cars hitting one another nonstop. Oftentimes we hear in the news about a 30-car pileup because of either heavy fog, blizzard, whiteout, blizzard conditions, people simply following each other too closely. I mean, it could be for a whole host of reasons. And it could shut down an interstate, probably at best, not only for an entire day, but maybe 2 days at best, portions of an interstate. So yes, you have blinding snow that halts the aircraft for extensive time periods, on top of air temperatures dropping sharply. And this is the big kicker of them all here, folks. How about 9 inches of ice having developed onto 2 40-foot lifeboats? You know, it's awkward enough. You might have 1 to 2 inches of ice, but how about 9 inches of ice? You wouldn't think of sending any lifeboats out into the waters. But then again, the reason why you can't send these lifeboats out there, it's not so much that 9 inches of ice have developed on them, but there's no way of being able to launch them. Per the first evening when the search began, the Acacia spotted a victim with a life jacket floating along the water. Unfortunately, bad weather conditions such as choppy waves to pitch black, or I should say complete darkness, made things all the more hard when it came to recovering this particular victim's body, which was in the nearby vicinity, but the weather conditions just did not allow for a proper safe and rescue mission to take place. Did a Coast Guard vessel Acacia go about recovering a fair share of deceased SS Daniel J. Morrell crewmen from the water? Yes, many of the Acacia's deck crew were well experienced when it came to the practice of hooking and tending to buoys. The hooks sent out onto the water were intended to catch onto something, such as a crewman's clothing or their life jacket, that would give them more proper means of being able to bring them on board the vessel. Some of the crewmen's bodies, folks, once pulled in, were found to be in terrible shape. Well, I mean, for one, it would be fair to say that many of these crewmen obviously died from elements pertaining to hypothermia. But there was something else that came about as well. Seagulls, folks, had feasted on some of the bodies. I'm not trying to gross you all out, but I think we should be reminded that Coast Guard crewmen see just about everything. They're not immune from anything. I'm sure many of these crewmen would like to think that they would never come across a search and rescue where some bodies, or more than just some bodies, have not been in the best of shape. In this case, because of seagulls feasting on deceased bodies. So fortunately, the Coast Guard vessel Acacia was able to bring all these bodies on board. Where do you think they would have gotten placed? They were placed onto the boat's deck, where they remained, but they were covered with tarps. All the bodies got placed in their own tarp. I don't know if they're in their own tarp, but they were covered in tarps as a means of protection, as a means of, they have already passed on, but we could give them privacy. We could even give others privacy. I mean, we could give, you know, yes, it's one thing to be exposed and having to see a dead crewman, or say half a dozen of dead crewmen. But don't you think even the deceased should have their privacy? In other words, do they want the rest of the world looking at them left and right? Maybe not right away. I don't know. It's a touchy matter, but thank heavens that the Acacia did provide enough tarps for those men whom were pulled up onto the vessel. The Acacia's arrival to Harbor Beach saw the victims be transported onto trucks and ambulances, where they would go onward to the funeral home. As I've said before from a previous podcast, and I'll say it again, I do remember my father telling me years ago that when he was growing up, the ambulances were not at the hospitals. They were at funeral homes. It was just the policy of the time, but it is something that we should be reminded of, that ambulances at one time were not always confined to hospitals, but instead at funeral homes. In terms of all the rescue boats that participated in this greater search effort, they used what was called a grid pattern. This grid pattern that they went about incorporating per their greater search, the grid pattern covered 400 square miles of Lake Huron. That's a lot of square miles, folks, 400 square miles of Lake Huron. Day one of the search around 4 p.m., being the same time that Dennis Hale was spotted, two helicopters and a small lifeboat all came upon seven bodies. It was determined later that the seven bodies had all drifted south for 12 miles. 12 miles, folks, from where the SS Daniel J. Morrell's bow section had sunk. So keep in mind, folks, if someone or, say, a group of sailors have died, their bodies aren't just going to stay in one place. The waves have a way of knocking people around. Currents are strong. They can, you know, drag bodies from point A to point B. Other conditions, if they are just right, can have a play a part as well. How about those strong gale force winds? They probably had something to do in moving those bodies around so quickly to where, yes, they would have drifted as long as they did, being 12 miles from where the SS Morrell's bow section had sunk. The first victims that were rescued and identified were 8 crewmen. Let's find out their names. Well, for starters, Captain Arthur Crawley was amongst the 8 whom was rescued and identified. First Mate Philip Capetz. Second Mate Duncan McLeod. Wheelsmen Stuart Campbell and Henry Rishmiller. Watchman Albert Huem and Norman Bragg. To Ordinary Deck Watch, Larry Davis. All 8 of these victims that were rescued and identified, they had all worn life jackets. And most of them, like Dennis Hale, were all thrown off the vessel into Lake Huron's frigid waters. I can't imagine seeing firsthand having to bring up deceased crewmen, but also having to go about identifying, going about having to make a determination as to how maybe they were thrown off the vessel. It's not just the families that are probably hurting. I can imagine that the Coast Guard's hurting too. I mean, they are doing everything they can to perform a brave search and rescue mission. But I would have no doubts that for some of these Coast Guard crewmen, it's very possible that maybe they know of someone whom had once endured a terrible storm along the Great Lakes and live to tell the story. But at the same time, maybe for some crewmen, for some Coast Guard crewmen, they probably knew of friends whom had lost a loved one in a terrible storm in the month of November. Dennis Hale awoke more than once during his first night in the hospital. His body temperature, along with other essential vitals, were checked regularly. The nurses placed hot water bottles around him as a means for helping raise his body temperature, which rose to 97.4 degrees. So, you know, folks, normal human body temperature is 98.6. And of course, if our body temperature went to like 100 or more, yeah, we'll probably have we could probably have a bad fever. Or for example, if it's very hot outside and we don't hydrate and other factors can sit in, we could have what's called heat exhaustion or worst case scenario, a heat stroke. But we should keep in mind, in this case, Dennis Hale's body temperature was well below 98.6 when he was rescued. So the fact that it rose to 97.4 degrees during his first night in the hospital, that's a very good sign of relief. Given that all of this changed for the better in terms of improvement within 1.5 hours after he had first been admitted. So quite a leap of modified success, to say the least. Hang tight for just a moment, folks. How about this question? Was Dennis Hale aware that he would soon have to talk with news reporters about the SS Daniel J. Morrell sinking? Yes, Dennis Hale knew that it was just a matter of time before he was going to have to talk with news reporters. For one, he probably already knew that the incident itself was becoming headline news. Or how about front page news. But headline news more so per front page newspapers within the local and outlying areas. So in other words, I think it would be fair to say that what is going on right now with the SS Daniel J. Morrell, given that it occurred in Michigan, I don't believe Pacific Coast states like California, Oregon, and Washington State are going to know about this. What I do know is that many of towns in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, as well as along the mainland, perhaps northern Ohio, northeast Ohio, maybe northwest Pennsylvania, western New York, including other states whose boundaries touch one of the Great Lakes. Like, for example, northwest Indiana touches the southernmost part of Lake Michigan. So the bottom line is this, folks, is that while, yes, Dennis Hale's story will make headlines, it may not make national headlines, but at the same time, he knows that that the incident itself is gradually becoming front page news, from a local area, but from outlying areas. Secondly, interest in the incident itself was growing. So if interest in the incident is growing, then it's just going to be a matter of time before you will need to say some information that you know is necessary to share with the reporters. Greater public, aka the news outlets, the reporters, they saw Hale's survival as something miraculous. And if you're a reporter and you have learned that one man has survived out of just shy of 30 crewmen, yeah, to me that would be miraculous. Yes, why not have your title or newspaper headline title be the miracle survivor, miracle on the lake, miracle in the month of November, something that might have positive, relevant meaning. But for Dennis Hale, though, internally, he knew that while his survival was remarkable, he had endured circumstances beyond his control. And I think we all ought to agree with that one by now. Dennis Hale personally believed that maybe the media should be paying more attention right now towards those crewmates still considered missing. And if I were in his shoes, I'd probably say the same thing too. If you want to, at some point, yes, I don't have a problem talking to you all. It's just not yet, but if I were you all, or if I was in your all's shoes, why not be more concerned about the crewmates that are still missing? Dennis Hale's first full day in the hospital saw him meet with Art Dobson, Bethlehem Steel's Cleveland dispatcher, including two Coast Guard officers. Nobody, believe it or not, folks, knew anything yet about the Morrell sinking, despite victims and debris already being picked up. Hale himself talked with all three men for 1.5 hours regarding the storm, the vessel coming apart, to his own survival on the raft, knowing how painful, or I should say how tense, the entire ordeal itself was altogether. Prior to going forward and speaking with the news reporters, did Dennis Hale have any family members present on site? Yes, he was surrounded by his wife, Bertha, along with his stepmother and stepbrother. So it is good to know that that for one, Dennis's wife has already been made aware of the matter, and two, she has also gone about contacting his stepmother and stepbrother, so that this way they are aware. And so this way, with the three of them being there, Dennis can feel better assured that he is surrounded by people who care about him and want what's best for him, not just short term but long term. While all of this was going on, the Morrell incident was still an evolving or we should say unfolding breaking news status. Reporters were in need, or I should say in a time crunch. Think about it, in 1966, is there such a thing as a time crunch? Yes. Just like there is today, a time crunch to get a story published so that it will be in next day's newspaper. So yes, the reporters are in need or are in a time crunch for writing articles, not only about the Morrell's sinking, but also with regards to Dennis Hale's survival, as well as the overall search for survivors. Deadlines behind newspaper stories surrounding Morrell's sinking were very tight. Everybody wanted to be the first to get this in their local newspaper. I mean, they wanted to be the one, just about everybody wanted to be the first to report this groundbreaking news story, because to them it was headline news at this time. Bertha, being Dennis Hale's wife, had told reporters how terrified her husband was of storms. And I know some of you might be saying, well, if he was terrified of storms, why did he go out on the water? Well, remember, folks, much early on, or way early on in this series, or this book topic series, we learned that Dennis Hale had had some tardiness, and we knew that we learned that he had a big opportunity to seize by going out one last time. Not only would he get a bonus, but that bonus money would help him through the off season. Not only just for Dennis himself, but that of his family. Extra bonus money does go a long way. So the irony to it is that Dennis Hale and his wife had talked about finding work on land, but the unfortunate thing was that there was really nothing on land that was feasible that could provide him a steady income. So therefore, he saw the waters and working on being a part of a Great Lakes freighter. It offered more money, more incentives, probably far more means of acquiring bonuses than, say, working on land. I'm not saying that by working on land that you can't get a bonus, but perhaps where he was living at the time, perhaps a lot of workplaces came and went. There just wasn't enough long-term job security on land as there was by water. Dennis Hale, by the time he talks to the reporters, He explains to the reporters how he had endured multiple bouts of hallucinations while clinging on for dear life in the life raft prior to getting rescued by the Coast Guard. Did Dennis Hale offer any explanations behind why he survived? Yes, he provided two total, with the first being the following, and this is all in quotations, folks. Listen carefully. First, perhaps God wants me to be alive, Hale said. Number two, and secondly, perhaps God wants me to suffer before I die. All right, and I'm sure some of you are wondering now, how could you sum this up? All right, here we go. Dennis Hale knew he had a purpose for living, but yet he was forced to come to the realization that hardships, including ones beyond unforeseeable imagination, would occur before his time expired. How he would respond to those hardships in the midst of uncertain times could either make or break how he chose to view life. To me, folks, this is the best I can offer in terms of phrasing what Dennis Hale said in quotes, but I do believe it has a lot of merit, to say the least. Hale's explanations behind why he survived echoed in the newspapers. But believe it or not, folks, even in 1966, newspaper reporters did make errors, just like they do today. There were errors in nearly every account. Some stories confirmed Dennis Hale having shared a raft with Captain Arthur Crawley, First Mate Philip Capetz, and Second Mate Duncan MacLeod, despite those three men's bodies already picked up by Acacia the day before. So the reporters don't know that Dennis, they were all under the assumption that Dennis Hale was by himself. He wasn't. There were three men with Dennis Hale: Art Stoechek, John Cleary, Charles Fassbender. But yet the reporters didn't know that. Maybe Dennis Hale just didn't want to give them that information, because he was still in so much shock. He was still enduring a lot of internal grief. Remember, he's still thinking about the three men whom died on that raft. Hjalmer Edwards? His first name is spelled H-J-A-L-M-E-R. Hjalmer Edwards. I can tell you he's of Swedish descent. That's what Michael Schumacher talked about in the book. But Hjalmer Edwards is a 61-year-old man whom had extensive experience in commercial shipping along Great Lakes waters. Edwards himself began working as chief steward for Columbia and Hutchinson lines before going to work on the SS Daniel J. Morrell. He worked, how ironic, folks, that he worked on a freighter known as the CG Post. Wasn't that the freighter that came to Dennis Hale's rescue? It sure was. But the CG Post here, folks, found the first Morrell casualty. For Hjalmer Edwards, he worked on the Morrell since September of 66. He didn't know Dennis Hale directly, but he knew that the Morrell's morale was very strong, that there was a strong camaraderie amongst all the crewmen, even in the midst of Captain Arthur Crawley taking over halfway through the 1966 shipping season. For Hjalmer Edwards, you know, we've learned so much about Dennis Hale's ordeal. Hjalmer Edwards' ordeal is the exact opposite. He was actually on the Morrell just before Thanksgiving of 66. He left the SS Daniel J. Morrell on Thanksgiving Day, folks, a couple of days before the Morrell went missing and ultimately sank. He didn't leave for selfish reasons, folks. He felt sick. And he got sick to the point where he developed pneumonia from a bad cold. So I think it's fair to say that not only was he thinking about himself when he left, he was probably thinking about what was best for the rest of the crew. Did he want to get the rest of the crew sick? Think about it. You get the rest of your crew sick, or a majority of them, you are going to delay, the trip. You could delay the trip maybe by a week or two at most, and then you've got angry chief executives or angry corporate level officials whom can't understand why the Morrell did not make it all the way to Taconite Harbor to pick up that extra load of iron ore. Well, you can't control illnesses, but at the same time, for Hjalmer Edwards, he was thankful to be alive, but the unfortunate thing was that he mourned for those. The unfortunate thing is that he knew some of the crewmen whom passed away on board the Daniel J. Morrell. And for those men whom perished, it was a very tough ordeal for him. So, yes, we have Dennis Hale, who's been stranded out on the water for hours on hours, the only one who survived out of four men on board that raft. And then we have Hjalmer Edwards, who could have been on that voyage himself, but was spared because he knew that he needed to get better in the midst of battling pneumonia. Were any other bodies recovered from Lake Huron prior to the second day of the search coming to a close? Yes, the Coast Guard recovered 9 bodies total on the second day of searching. The 9 men were from the Morel Stern. So in other words, the 9 men that were rescued, the Coast Guard determined that they had been thrown off the ship via the stern, aka the back. Come into the second day search, 21 crewmen, folks, including Dennis Hale himself, had been accounted for. The deceased crewmen's bodies were taken to Harbor Beach and got split up between the city's 2 funeral homes. Well, think about it, folks. One funeral home alone cannot accommodate 21 deceased crewmen's bodies. So it's very likely that one funeral home might have 12 bodies, the other one's going to have 9 at this point in time. Just 48 hours earlier, Bethlehem Steel Company's owners simply assumed that all was well and that the SS Daniel J. Morel would be arriving into Taconite Harbor, Minnesota, to pick up a load of iron ore. Yeah, it's so easy to assume that everything's just going to go fine without a hitch. If we were in the red, we'll be back up in the green. Everything's going to be great, and we can end the year on a better note in terms of revenue. Well, the exact opposite now has come into play, folks. It's not so much that the goods are going to be late in getting delivered on time, or that load of iron ore isn't going to be picked up on time, but now we've got a little bit of a problem in that we're dealing now not only with the loss of a vessel, but how about 28 men? 28 men, folks, and Dennis Hale's the only one that's been rescued? Okay, that's 29 men total aboard this vessel. So, yes, not only are Bethlehem Steel officials dealing with the loss of a vessel, now they're going to have to deal with the potential loss of 28 men whom required proper identification to notifying the families of all the deceased crewmen and potential, folks, get this, potential court lawsuits. And then how about a potential investigation behind what led to the SS Morel's demise, sinking? I'm glad I'm not in these corporate guys' shoes. Not that they are bad people, but I just feel like they have made some improper decisions in terms of how to go about conducting proper protocol procedures in the event something unforeseeable happens, which in this case it has unraveled. But what was the first mistake which owners of the SS Daniel J. Morel made? If you had to pick one, what would it be? I know, they failed in not making any efforts to notify the crewmen's families once learning right away that the ship had been reported missing. Okay, if you know that the ship, that the Daniel J. Morel has been reported missing, wouldn't you think that these men would have had used some common sense to not only go ahead and put out an all-points bulletin and to get the Coast Guard and other search and rescue vehicles out on the water, but you need to notify the families right away to let them know that we've already got a search and rescue mission going underway. You all will be notified as soon as we know of anything. But no, none of that was done. Some families, though, folks, did learn about the tragedy before Bethlehem Steel's company's owners did. How so? They learned about it through other means of communication, most notably a radio. Cecilia Stochek was in the middle of washing dishes when having learned of the SS Morel sinking. Mrs. Stochek, folks, fell to the ground right away. I can't imagine being in her house, whether I was related to her or not, or just a neighbor coming to, say, return something of hers, and all of a sudden we hear on the news, on the radio, that the Daniel J. Morel being the vessel that Cecilia Stoicek's husband was on, is now sunk. Yeah, I don't know how Mrs. Stoicek could get over that one. How about Jan Fossbender, the wife of Charles Fossbender, whom was in the raft with Dennis Hale? Jan Fossbender listened by radio of the Morell situation, but did not get advised of her husband's body discovery until next day's newspaper, which had reported only one survivor, being Dennis Hale. Was the FBI involved with the SS Daniel J. Morell's victim identification process procedure? The answer is yes. I know that is going to come as a surprise to you all, and thinking, how in the world would the FBI be involved in something like this? Well, the FBI agents had on them fingerprint files when making their way to Harbor Beach, and the agents went about taking prints of each victim's right index finger, which enabled them to secure matches. So there you have it, folks. I mean, you do need to bring people into situations when it's least expected amongst the majority of us. Once identifications got made by the FBI agents, all victims' families were informed. Now, why is the number 9 important? That was the total number of bodies recovered on the second day of search and rescue. The 9 bodies, or I should say the 9 men whose bodies were recovered were Chief Engineer John Schmidt, First Assistant Engineer Valmore Marchilladon, Fireman Chester Konishka and Arthur Fargo, Oiler Wilson Simpson, Coal Passer Leon Truman, Second Cook Nicholas Homick, Porters Joseph Masem and Charles Sestakaskus. Sorry, I'm trying to pronounce that name as best as I can, folks. Charles Sestakaskus. Sounds like a Greek last name, but that's the best I can do with pronouncing it. And how many SS Daniel J. Morell crewmen were picked up by the time the search itself came to an end come December 5th? 22. 21 deceased crewmen, including Dennis Hale himself. But 5 days afterwards, folks, on December 10th, Saverio Grippi's body was located along a lake in Tiverton, Ontario. Saverio Grippi was a native of Ashtabula, Ohio, and was a good friend of Dennis Hale's. Now, if you really want to be taken by surprise, let's forward, not to leap way too forward into the future, but with regards to search and rescue, recovering bodies and all that, why don't we forward 4 months later in mid-April of 1967? Oiler Don Wooster's remains were found around Southampton, Ontario. I can't imagine, just 5.5 months after the Morell sank, that the Coast Guard would still be finding bodies in some of the most in some places where they just simply didn't expect bodies to be washed ashore. But there again, currents and waters do have a way of pushing bodies from point A to point B in places that we just don't expect them to be pushed to. So yes, Don Wooster's remains were sadly found around Southampton, Ontario. One day later, on April 16th of 1967, Ernie Marcotte, the Morell's third mate, appeared around the same area as deceased crewman Don Wooster. Remember early on that Dennis Hale rode with a fella named John Groh? Well, what happened to Steward Stanley Sotlawa and deckhand John Groh? Folks, this was very startling and it's very sad, but it does need to be told. Because too often we always assume that for those people whom are missing, we always assume that their bodies, if they are confirmed to be dead, we always would like to believe that their bodies will be found and that they will get a proper burial. Sadly, for Steward Stanley Satlawa and deckhand John Groh, their bodies were never found, folks. To this day, their bodies have never, ever been found. John Groh, as I said earlier, he rode with Dennis Hale to meet up with the SS Daniel J. Morrell in Windsor, Ontario, given that they had each missed the vessel departure from Lackawanna, New York. Two other men, folks, in late May of 1967, their bodies were found. Coal passer David Price and second assistant engineer Alfred Norkunas. Their bodies were found come late May of 1967. How is Dennis Hale going to be told about the news before him? Because he is still clinging on to some belief that maybe, just maybe, 5 or 10 men at most were rescued. They are alive. That's what he wants to believe. Well, we all would if we were in his shoes. But Dennis Hale, folks, has now been told that time unto itself and the brutal weather conditions that took place simply made things very difficult for others to have survived. Despite some life jackets, life rings, oars, 2 life rafts, and some wreckage debris all being located. While all of that is maybe good in a sense, because it maybe can help piece together, it might sound crazy to say, but you know, it may have to be considered a crime scene. I mean, yes, the ship has sunk, but they can close off the area to those whom should not be on the around the shoreline. But the fact is that while, yes, life jackets, life rings, oars, 2 life rafts, and some wreckage debris have all been found, the one thing that hasn't been found, folks, are living crewmen. Dennis Hale, folks, is the only survivor of the SS Daniel J. Morrell. I cannot imagine being now one of 29 crewmen who survived. It would have been one thing if I were one of 5 who survived. It might have been one thing if I was one of 4, if I myself and my 3 other mates on the life raft survived. If the 4 of us had survived, that would have been beyond miraculous. But it didn't happen that way, folks. Only 1 man survived. And now he's got to wonder to himself, when I get released from the hospital, are the other families who lost their loved ones, are they going to come to me and give me a hug and understand the ordeal that I went through? I should tell you all this now. I'm not going to try to give away a whole lot, but I'll just tell you this now. We do need to be reminded that sometimes when people survive ordeals like what Dennis Hale has survived, we often want to believe that everybody gets a hero's welcome. I should just point out right now that we just need to be reminded that not everyone gets a hero's welcome back home. And to me, that's not right. But sometimes it does happen, and it will be discussed more in another episode somewhere down the road. Well, that covers everything for this segment episode to Torn in Two, the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and one man's survival on the open sea. When I'm on the air again next, we are going to be talking about the public autopsy, or I should say public autopsy, the Coast Guard hearings. Thank you for your time as always, and wherever you may live, continue to stay safe. Thank you for being such ardent listeners. You all are the best. Take care.